Hello and welcome to the very first episode of The Plane Controller, a podcast where I, an air traffic controller and a pilot, talk about all things aviation related. From behind the scenes, realities, and day-to-day stories to stuff that really annoys us on frequency, pilots and air traffic controllers included. We're going to dive right on into all of that. My name's Austin, and thank you for joining me. Quick intro about me before we get into the nitty-gritty of this episode. Just so you know who I am and if I really am who I say I am. I've been an air traffic controller for the last 5 years. I've worked in a tower-only environment the entire time with the chance to move on to a TRACON or RAPCON or center, maybe, one day in my career. And over the last 5 years, I've seen a lot of things. I've worked a lot of military aircraft. I've worked a lot of civilian aircraft, to include general aviation or airliners. Majority of my experience has been with military aircraft. More recently, I became a pilot. About 6 months ago, I finally got my check ride done. I had started it at the time of this recording, just a little less than a year ago. It just finally worked out for me that I could actually work towards it. And I got it done before, within less than 6 months. And becoming a pilot, while it's great to see that side of it, it also just kind of opened up my eyes as a controller. It made me learn new things from a pilot's perspective that changed how I controlled aircraft. Even though most of the time it was just, small aircraft, Cessna 172s. Nothing more than that. I never flew anything else other than that during my flight training. So when you've been on both ends of the frequency, you start to realize how much misunderstanding happens between controllers and pilots, that's part of the reason why I decided to start this podcast. One is just to kind of talk it out, and maybe talking about it, even though I'm by myself, if I'm able to talk about it, maybe I'll be able to learn something from it at the same time. Maybe kind of open my eyes to other sides of the aviation industry that I didn't know about before. The other reason is because I have been pretty much an aviation fanatic since before I was born. My dad's a pilot, now works for the FAA. Obviously, I'm a controller. And my grandfather, he's an aircraft mechanic. My grandmother, my mom's side, was also a pilot. She gave my dad his first flight lesson many years ago. So my family has been around aviation for quite some time. But yeah, mainly the reason why I wanted to talk about, just talk about aviation. I don't claim to be an expert on any of it, but I just like to have discussions. So that is me pretty much in a very simplified nutshell. So I want to kind of just talk about what this podcast is going to be. Obviously I said this would be aviation related, but that doesn't really tell you exactly what it's going to be about, because there's plenty of other podcasts that you could listen to that would discuss aviation, which some of them might be better answering questions, especially if they specialize in one field. of aviation. Like, I would never be, I would never consider myself or claim to be an expert in the components of an aircraft besides what I've learned as a, in pilot training and flights at flight school. And I will not claim to be an expert when it comes to any kind of TRACON or RAPCON procedures or rules, I guess, because I don't deal with that on a day-to-day basis. But I think there might be a gap between the real world. I don't want to say the real world, but the world outside of aviation where people don't really know much about it. Maybe they don't necessarily care too much. They have to deal with it when they're traveling. And then maybe, you know, some pilots will get upset with ATC, and there's some controllers who get upset with pilots, but they don't really get the scope. They don't see the big picture of both ends. And I'm hoping to kind of like merge that with this podcast. So one of the things I want to talk about specifically with this episode is a couple misconceptions that maybe the general public has with aviation, whether it's the pilots or air traffic controllers. And then the second misconception I want to discuss is mostly towards the controllers out there who don't have any kind of flight training. So that's going to be the two big things that I want to discuss for this particular episode, and further on we'll figure out other things. I do have like, you know, thoughts of what I want to talk about in later episodes. But for this one, I think I just wanted to stick with the two misconceptions. So, misconception number one is that air traffic control are the reason for delays. And this is going out to the general public who would read in a news article that says, you know, ATC causes delays at such and such airport. This is not always the case. Or maybe it is the case, but the media writes in a way because they don't understand it either. They just say Tower is not letting people go, or TRACON or Center is not letting people take off or land, and that equates to air traffic control is not providing the service that customers expect. So, is ATC ever the cause of a delay? Sure, it happens. And I would say recently, when I say recently, probably within the last 5 to 10 years, it's probably a staffing issue, especially since COVID happened. People were not able to work. They took an early retirement or a severance. Specifically, when I talk about this, I mean the FAA, military controllers who have to deal with civilian aircraft. Not really the case unless they got out right after. And yes, yeah, staffing is an issue. So let me kind of break it down a little bit when it comes to what I mean by staffing issues. So obviously, there's the lack of manning at each facility, or not necessarily a lack, but a decrease in personnel working at one facility. The Federal Aviation Administration, or the FAA, mandates that controllers only work a certain amount of days per week and only works a set number of hours per day. And this goes for pretty much any facility, whether it's Tower, the TRACON, or Center. They are only allowed to work 6 days a week for a maximum of 10 hours a day. And there are plenty of other jobs out there that, you know, say that you are allowed to work 7 days a week. You're allowed to work, you know, 12 hours a day. ATC is not one of those career fields that allow that. It is essentially a law. It's more of a, it's a regulation that says that you cannot work more than 6 hours, or sorry, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. And depending on the staffing requirements or the facility, and depending on what shift you're on, you must have a minimum of 10-hour break between the time that you get off work and the time you return to work. If you're on mids, which means you're working between 10:30 p.m. and 6:30 a.m., you must have a minimum of 12 hours between shifts. And as far as breaks go, the FAA requires that you have a minimum of 30 minutes as a break, for a break. Depending on the facility and the workload, usually some facilities would allow longer breaks, but the FAA requires a minimum of 30 minutes, and most people take their lunch break or dinner break, whatever shift they're working. I know some facilities do not always do that, just depending on the workload, but also the manning that is presently at the facility. So I'll give a different example. So you have FAA control towers. Those are usually at the bigger airports, but there are smaller airports that do not have FAA control towers. They're usually what we call contract towers. So private organizations get hired out by the FAA to control the airport. There's a few out there that are in the United States. I'm not entirely sure what exists overseas. I know that they have their own aviation regulation that they must follow. But I know that, at least in the United States, you have contract towers, and their rules are they're definitely different. You also don't have the same pay scale that FAA hired controllers have. So, and as far as FAA goes, maybe that's causing the delays, because the FAA requires mandated breaks, but also they can't work 7 days a week. They can't work more than 10 hours a day. So that's possibly one delay. There is also the possibility of a ground stop. So a ground stop means nobody is taken off. It could be issues with the runway. It could have been because of an accident. Could have been from other. Could be a security issue, or it could be that there's an issue with airspace congestion nearby the airport, which again goes back to ATC staffing delays. There's just too many aircraft for the controllers working that facility can handle. A ground stop means that no one can take off from that airport. Could be because there's an emergency that happened there and there's an accident that impacted runway operations. So that's another one. And I haven't seen that happen in any of the towers I've worked in, but we would get notifications of airports that are directing ground stops. But ATC would be the one to relay that if the airline ops don't relay that to the pilots. And there's another type of delay that maybe people blame ATC for, is weather delays. And the reality is your departure point of departure, it could be blue skies, it could be sunny, not a cloud in the sky, great weather. but your arrival airport, your destination, not the case. Could be, you know, hailing, could be thunderstorming, heavy rain, tornadoes, anything of that nature. It's gonna prevent you from taking off. But the issue is that the media likes to say that air traffic control is causing delays. Sometimes, and I'll give them the credit for this, is that they will say that, and then in their actual article they'll break it down saying there's a weather stop. But the headline is, you know, typically delays are caused by air traffic control. To some degree, that's what it says. I would argue that most delays, if they're not the weather or a ground stop, is because of manning issues. If a tower is required to be open, or sorry, if a facility, air traffic control facility, is required to be open 24/7, like the centers are, but they don't have the manning to support like so many flights at one time, then people are going to be delayed. If it's not either of those, it's usually because we're the ones trying to make the system work in spite of all the things that are already broken. We're dealing with, as I said, you know, congestion, airline overscheduling, aircraft spacing requirements, equipment outages, pilot reports, any kind of weather restrictions. I mean, you name it. There's a lot of rules that controllers have to abide by to make sure that you are able to safely take off and land at your destination airport or from your departure airport. And I've been in the same shoes where my flight gets delayed 30 minutes to an hour, maybe gets canceled altogether. I'll give you an example. About a year ago, I was supposed to be going, actually, I think it was about this time last year, I was supposed to be going to Palm Springs, California. I was taken off from Panama City, Florida. I had one layover in Dallas, and then that was supposed to take me directly to Palm Springs. Well, lo and behold, I get to Panama City Airport, and I get there hours early. I'm telling you, like, they were telling me, because it was the July 4th, around the July 4th weekend, get there 3 hours in advance. So I'm sitting there at 4:30. I'm the first one in line because I'm taking American Airlines. And no one was at the front desk. They don't show up until, I don't know, I think it was like 6 a.m. And I get, you know, through security. I check my bags, I go through security, and then I go to the gate. And I'm sitting there, and it says, the plane has been delayed, and next expected boarding time is like 7:30. I'm like, okay, well, that's great. I think I should be good. I might be pushing it for my connecting flight, but it is what it is. 30 minutes, another 30 minutes go by, and I finally get on the plane. I'm like, okay, if I get to Dallas on time, as of now on time, like, you know, an hour after when I was supposed to get there originally, I should be good. But I'm sitting in the back of the plane. So I get to Dallas, and I miss boarding by 3 minutes. I've missed it because it took a while to taxi to the gate. So I don't get to Palm Springs that day when I was supposed to get there. So I'm stuck in Dallas overnight, which is fine. I like Dallas. I walked around where I was staying. It was some hotel, and there was a couple barbecue places, you know, perfect for Texas. And I stay there overnight, and then I have my flight rebooked for, I think it was like 10 a.m. to go, instead of directly to Palm Springs, it goes to Phoenix, because they had no more flights directly to Palm Springs the next day. I get to, I take off, we start going to Phoenix, and about 15 minutes before my flight, before I'm supposed to, I land, I get a notification through the app that says, your flight to Palm Springs has been canceled. And I'm like, okay, well, this is strange. Why is it canceled? It's the middle of the day. Turns out it's too hot. It's too hot in Palm Springs. I've never been there, so I wouldn't know that. But it was too hot. To the point where the runway was essentially going to stick, you know, melt and stick to the landing gear. And they obviously are not going to do that. But it just shows that... Sorry, I'll go back. I didn't get to Palm Springs until the next day. It took about 3 days to get from Panama City to Palm Springs. And it is what it is. I mean, it was weather. It's too hot. Probably dangerous. Super dangerous for the pilots and passengers. It's a hazard to the aircraft to land on a runway that's too hot. But that just shows you that weather is usually going to be an issue. I didn't go and say, this is air traffic control's fault that is canceled. I know that it's because of weather. And I know that it's not air traffic control's fault that I departed Panama City too late. It's probably an issue with the aircraft because things happen to aircraft all the time. It's usually not bad, but pilots obviously are not going to risk taking off if their plane is not airworthy. Your departure got pushed 25 minutes, but it's not because the person just hates your flight number or hates the pilot or whatever. It's just because 5 sectors down the line are already full and someone's trying to make the dominoes fall just right. Earlier, I talked about how controllers are dealing with congestion, airline overscheduling, spacing requirements, equipment outages. Those are all very true, especially the aircraft spacing requirements and the equipment outages. So, per the FAA, controllers are required to give a minimum amount of space between planes. Especially if they are flying IFR, which is instrument flight rules, so they're following their instruments to their destination, instead of VFR, which is visual flight rules, where they are looking outside and then focusing sometimes on their instruments, but they're just going based off landmarks they can see. That's what the VFR is. IFR is following a GPS or getting radar vectors, you know, the entire time from controllers. So for depending on the size of the plane, I'll give you an example. A Boeing 737 is a large plane, and I mean that by weight class. There's four types of weight categories for aircraft. So you have small, large, heavy, and super. And there's only a few supers. There was one that was one of the most famous ones is one of the Ukrainian supers that no longer exists due to being destroyed a few years ago. But then you have heavies and then large and smalls. Smalls are typically your general aviation aircraft. You think like a Cessna 172, Piper, stuff like that. Large could be typically any military fighter aircraft, F-22, F-16, F-35, Boeing 737s, A-320s, A-319s, stuff of that nature. Heavies are like your 747s, military refuelers like the KC 135s or the C-17s, C-5s, those are all heavies. So going back to the weight categories of large, the large weight category, you have to have a minimum of 3 miles separation between aircraft. And, you know, the altitudes help out a lot, too, if they're having, if they're separated by enough altitude, that is not a factor. But if they're going to the same destination, they can't get closer than 3 miles. So that's just while they're en route to their next facility, or sorry, their destination. And the rules are different for the larger aircraft, the heavy aircraft and super aircraft. Usually the separation between aircraft increases. If you have a heavy in front of a large, it increases. If you have a heavy in front of a heavy, it also increases. It keeps, again, the minimum separation for IFR aircraft is 3 miles, and it can go all the way up to 6 miles, depending on the weight category of the aircraft. I also talked about how equipment outages cause delays. And I'll give you a prime example of that. So I don't remember the exact dates. I just remember that there was one day when my radar completely goes out. In tower, we deal with a lot of VFR aircraft, whether it's military or civilian, including the smaller, you know, Cessna aircraft. But then we have F-16s, F-35s, F-22s come over and play in the pattern a little bit. So we rely on a lot of VFR. However, our visibility outside of the tower only goes so far. And aircraft, unless they are the heavier type or the bigger types, you're not going to see them that far out unless it's dark out and they have the lights on, their landing light at least. But when it's clear outside, visibility is, you know, more than 10 miles, you're not going to be able to see aircraft that easily. So we rely on something called certified tower radar displays. There's another kind that's called the tower display workstation, where it's another type of radar, but it's not certified, so you can't, there's like limitations to it. I'll get into that maybe in a different episode. But we use that to look for other aircraft that are further out, as well as identify their call sign, their altitudes, maybe their speeds, to adjust how they, or figure out where they fit into the traffic pattern. Sometimes that display goes out, and it makes it way more difficult to sequence aircraft in. So what happens is we go non-radar, and the RAPCON or TRACON or center has to provide the separation all the way until final, until they are essentially over the threshold of the runway, which means that they're no longer going to be VFR, because usually if they're going to come back and play in the pattern, they're going to be VFR. Which means that they have to provide that separation, especially even if they are the same weight category. They still have to have miles of separation, and that flight will have separation in front of another flight that's behind them, and so on and so forth. It just keeps adding on. Sometimes our radios go out, and we have to call someone, and like it has to be like quick, like you have to get this fixed like immediately. Sometimes the people who can fix it are not around, and that takes some time to get them into the tower or the RevCon to work on them. We've had other issues where aircraft can't even talk to the controllers. Their radio goes out. And there's nothing you can really do about that in air besides maybe restarting your electrical system or your radios. But if you're flying, that's one thing you don't really want to worry about. Sometimes that is the case. All that to say, yes, ATC causes delays, but there's also other issues that ATC gets blamed for that are not necessarily caused by ATC. I hope I explained that well enough. I'm not entirely sure. Made sense to my brain. Misconception number two. This is mostly for the controllers out there who might be listening. If a pilot isn't talking to me as a controller, then they must be on guard frequencies. For the ones who are not controllers or pilots or are not familiar at all, guard frequencies are essentially the emergency frequencies, the frequencies that every facility has capabilities to talk to and listen to aircraft flying around. The frequencies are 121.5. That's the very high frequency, VHF frequency, that pilots use, controllers use, in the event that they can't reach anybody. Now, I've heard a lot of air controllers calling up on guard frequency to try and get in touch with an aircraft. If the facility is talking to an aircraft before, or if the aircraft was talking to a different facility, more than likely they're not going to be on guard frequency. If I had to guess, because I have not done this yet in my time as a pilot, if I had to guess, they put in the wrong frequency. They probably misdialed it, mistyped it, whatever the avionics on the aircraft are. They're not able to talk to you. That means that they are not keyed up on guard frequency, which means that they cannot hear you as a controller, as a pilot trying to listen to a controller. They're not able to hear you talk. And maybe there's a lot of controllers out there who believe or who already know that, but I'm sure there's quite a few controllers who do not know that. You assume that they can listen to, like, you can listen to guard, because as a controller, we listen to guard. Most of the time, that you're not able to talk to them is because it's a simple handoff error, or maybe they missed your call, or they didn't put in the right frequency. Handoff error meaning the previous controlling facility didn't hand off the aircraft in time, given the correct frequency and time that they were expected to be there. Missed call could be that they're listening to the ATIS and they're not able to. They could listen to you at the same time, but they're probably not going to be able to listen to both, because you have two different types of information coming at you at one time. It's just not going to work. And again, just a radio switch issue, just meaning that they put in the wrong frequency, possibly. There's also the chance that they are NORDO, which means that they just don't have radio capabilities, which I don't have to explain that to the controllers. It's more for the general public. More than likely, that may not be the issue, but it happens quite often, I would say. But yeah, pilots don't listen to 121.5 for fun. Unless they really want to, if they weren't already talking to you. If they're wearing flight following, they're going to be listening to you if they are able to. And by able to, I mean they have the capability of putting your frequency in. And then, now that I've flown, I can say with confidence that when the radio isn't working, it's a little bit stressful as well. Or if you're not sure who you're talking to. But usually it's because you think the radio isn't working. I know there was one time I was flying back from a different airport with my instructor, and I put in the frequency, and we triple checked it, trying keying up, no response. And we're like, okay, well, maybe we're just too far away, something like that. And I can tell you we're probably, you know, flying, I think we probably flew 10 or 15 miles at the time, by the time I finally was able to get a hold of the RAPCON. But we're thinking like, yep, our radio is dead. We're about to have to squawk 7600, which for people who don't know, that's a, hey, my radio isn't working beacon code. And I'm going to go back to the radios on an aircraft. So most aircraft, at least the aircraft that I flew in, had two radios. One was set up for the primary transmit receive, so I could talk to the tower, ground, RAPCON center, any kind of sectors. The other one was typically set up for the weather information, so I can get the ATIS information from the airports or the non-controlled airports, or you know, anything of that nature, really. But that's really the main reasons. There's also one other reason where the push-to-talk button on the aircraft stops working. Happens a lot, and I don't know what the word is. I wouldn't say poorly maintained aircraft, but not as well maintained aircraft, where the push to talk button just keeps the wires keep coming undone or loose, or you know, just torn off. Happened in one of the other planes I flew in, where the push to talk just wouldn't key up. So I was messing with my instructor's side before, or this was, I guess this was after I finished my flight training, when I was having issues with the radio. Just couldn't talk to ATC. So I had to pretty much nix that flight training that day because I'm not going to talk and try to take off without any kind of takeoff clearance. I'm not saying that you shouldn't try transmitting on guard, because you definitely should, just in case. But I would say most of the time it's not going to be the place the pilot is, unless they are also trying to get a hold of somebody because they got the wrong frequency or they misheard the frequency. So that is it for this first episode of the Plane Controller Podcast. I appreciate you listening if you made it this far. If you got questions, myths you might want debunked, or misconceptions that, or conceptions about aircraft or aviation that you've heard, or any kind of hot takes you want me to unpack, send them my way. My email is the.plane.controller@gmail.com. I'm also going to eventually make an Instagram where the username will probably be very similar to the email. You can send me a message on there if you want to, if that's easier. I've got a lot more coming. Maybe some ATC audio, maybe some my experiences as a student pilot. And there may be some other confessions from both sides of the mic. Until next time, fly safe, work safe, and I will catch you guys in the next podcast. See ya.